Well, this morning we continue our series, Who Do You Think You Are? So please come with me to Genesis chapter 49 and verses 19 and 20. Genesis 49, Jacob speaks, verse 19, Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. Verse 20, bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. So two tribes spoken of, 2 points. Point number one, the tribe of Gad. More than a match. Christian friend, are you a Gadite? I reckon we have a few Gadites in this church. We could do with a few more. What does Jacob say? Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. Perhaps a more helpful translation is, raiders shall raid Gad, but he shall raid at their heels. It's the language of warfare, of conflict. Why? Well, you have to understand which portion of the promised land was given to the tribe of Gad. Now, if I, standing here, represent the north, I know it's not the actual north, the north is somewhere over there, but for the moment, for our illustration, I'm standing in the north, and the middle aisle is the River Jordan. We'll let Norman, for the moment, be on one side of the Jordan. You're all right there. All you who are on the right, to the west, all of you are in the promised land. All of you on my left, to the east, all of you are in the luscious grasslands of what's called the Transjordan. The first few rows over here, you're the half-tribe of Manasseh. And that middle block, you're the tribe of Gad. And you at the back, you're the tribe of Reuben. Now, you're not in the promised land. What lies to the west? Well, as you look to the west, what is there is what's called the Great Sea. The Mediterranean. In other words, you're very well protected. You've got the Great Sea to your west, and to your east you've got the River Jordan, and then you've got these buffer tribes, half-tribe of Manasseh, the Gadites, and the Reubenites. Much of your time you'll live in peace. You're very well protected. You're insulated. You just have to watch what comes from the north. The Syrians, the Babylonians, but that's another story. But you Gadites, over there in the Transjordan, in the east, you're a border tribe. You live on the frontier. And to your east is the kingdom of the warlike Ammonites. We were thinking about those this morning. Nahash was a king of Ammon. They're a tribe who don't, well, they're a kingdom of people who don't know how to show mercy. You can read about them in Amos. Do you see? The Gadites have a vulnerable border. You're constantly exposed to raiders, to the incursions of marauding tribes. You daily live with the threat of attack. Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him. Raiders shall raid Gad. But does Gad take it all lying down? On the contrary, you mess with Gad at your peril. Because when they're attacked, they hit back hard. Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. Gad will repel the raids, pressing hard at the heels of his assailants. Now, Jacob loves his puns, doesn't he? And his words are actually a pun. Because in the original Hebrew, 4 of the 6 words that he speaks contain the sound Gad. So actually, the very word Gad itself means troop. So you could translate what Jacob says, troops shall troop against troop, but he shall troop on their retreat. It's a pun anyway. The point is this. What's going to happen to that frontier tribe? What's going to happen to the Gadites? Well, over the generations, if they're constantly exposed to attack and threat and raids, the tribe of Gad is going to learn to fight, to become skilled in the arts of war, to become valiant in battle, to become more than a match. And that's exactly what happened. Gad, the warlike tribe. Come with me to 1 Chronicles chapter 12. Don't worry if you can't find it, I'll read it out anyway. 1 Chronicles chapter 12, where we read of the growth of David's army before the capture of Jerusalem. And 1 Chronicles 12 verse 8 says this. Gadites joined David at the stronghold in the wilderness. Mighty men of valor, men trained for battle, who could handle shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions, and they were as swift as gazelles on the mountains. What more needs to be said? There are the Gadites, experienced, courageous, skilled, disciplined. We're told they're as ferocious as lions, as swift as gazelles. Gad, the complete soldier. Gad, more than a match. And if we have any doubts, verses 9 to 13, not only are their names given, so they're obviously men of reputation, men of renown, but verse 14 we read this. These were from the sons of Gad, captains of the army. The least was over 100, and the greatest was over 1,000. Better translated, the least was a match for 100, the greatest of them a match for 1,000. These are formidable soldiers. The least of them is a match for 100 men. Gad, more than a match. No wonder Moses was to say in Deuteronomy 33, Gad crouches like a lion. He tears off arm and scalp. He's a ferocious tribe. He's a warlike tribe. He's a lion-like tribe. You don't mess with Gad. He's learnt the hard way. He wasn't always like that, but by virtue of his position in the land, where he's constantly exposed to raiding and assault and attacks, it's turned him into this formidable warlike tribe. He's the complete warrior. He's had to be. Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. So, Christian friends, what about us? Have you heard of Shaka Zulu? In the 19th century, he transformed a tiny tribe into the greatest warrior nation in Africa, the Zulus. How did he do it? Well, amongst many things, he drilled his troops on ground covered with thorn bushes. Didn't that hurt? Yes, but it toughened their feet so they could dispense with clumsy footwear, so they could become as swift and as mobile as gazelles. What's more, instead of fighting with long spears, which were thrown at a distance, often to little effect, he equipped them with the short stabbing assegai, which meant they had to close with the enemy. They couldn't stand at a distance and throw their spear. They had to close and engage with their enemy hand to hand. Do you see, he trained his men for battle. He trained them to handle sword and spear. Until his disciplined regiments were invincible. As terrifying as lions, as swift as gazelles, Shaka Zulu. Well, Christian friend, has the captain of salvation, of your salvation, been training you? What does Shaka do? He drilled them on ground covered with thorns. Has the narrow way been hard? Has it been strewn with thorns? Has it cut and wounded your feet? Has every step been painful? And you've been wondering, is something wrong? But didn't you enlist in the king's army? Could it not be that the king, the captain of your salvation, is toughening your feet so you can dispense with that clumsy footwear, so that Hebrews 12, laying aside every weight and the sin that so easily ensnares us, it's so that you can run, so you can become swift and mobile in the warfare. And what does Shaka do? He equipped them with those short assegais. So they had to engage in hand-to-hand combat. So they had to close with the enemy. Is that what's happened to you? You've been engaged in hand-to-hand fighting. Paul talks of it as wrestling, doesn't he, in Ephesians chapter 6. Hand-to-hand wrestling against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. And you've been wondering, does the Christian life have to be so hard? but aren't you fighting a holy war? Look behind you. What do you see? A lion? For your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Look down. What do you see? A serpent waiting to bite? Look around you. What do you see? Well, everywhere you set your eyes, you're looking upon enemy territory. Throughout the day, you're walking the battlefield, ambushes around every corner. This world is not your friend. And if it is your friend, your danger is by far the greater. And look inside. What do you see? A wicked and deceitful heart waiting to betray you. Is it any surprise then that you're being trained in the use of that double-edged sword, the sword of the Spirit, the Word of God, so that you can engage in hand-to-hand warfare? And is it any surprise that you're learning the value of that other offensive weapon, what Paul describes as all prayer, all kinds of prayer for all kinds of people, in all kinds of situations? And now you're beginning to see the value of prayer. And now you're beginning to see the priority of the prayer meeting. Do you see? You've been called into the king's army to fight a holy war against the world, the flesh, and the devil. And that's why God is training you to be a Gadite. That's why, by his grace, he's training you to be more than a match with all that you meet. And besides, who knows what dangers lie ahead? Or who knows what campaigns he's going to launch in the service of the kingdom? Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. So God is training us all to be Gadites, to varying degrees. But maybe, Christian friend, you've been a Gadite from the beginning. It's in your spiritual DNA. If you drive an automatic car, you stop at the lights. What must you do? Well, if you don't put it into neutral, you must keep your foot on the brake. Otherwise, the car will move forward. And even as you sit there, you can hear the engine revving, straining to go forward, and you've got to hold it back. Well, Christian friend, is that you? You're a Gadite. You're raring to go. You're ready to engage in the warfare. Sometimes you've got to be held back. It's in your spiritual DNA, and you've got the wounds and the scars to show it. We had some at the chapel yesterday, ready to go out into the open air. Now, David Attenborough said this week that he receives hate mail from Christian viewers for failing to acknowledge God in his programs. He said, they tell me to burn in hell. I don't know what was in those letters, but certainly we want nothing to do with letters like that. In the name of Christ, we never tell anyone to burn in hell. Our spirit is that of the Lord Jesus Christ, who wept over Jerusalem. That should be our spirit. And such letters are cowardly, they're utterly unchristlike. That's not the way we conduct our warfare, is it? But Christian friend, has God made you a Gadite? He's made you to march to the sound of battle. And you're the woman, you're the man who, with that warm-hearted courage, you're able to step into a hostile arena, even into a bear pit, and there speak of Jesus. And when the truth is under assault, you're there first with the sword drawn, ready to defend it. And when God's people are feeling discouraged and defeated, you're the one to rally them to the cause and to put new heart into them. We read in 1 Chronicles 5 that the Gadites there, they trusted in God because they saw that the war was the Lord's. And that's you, ready for the spiritual warfare. Of course, that's why some Gadites are difficult to live with, aren't they? Because they're always spoiling for a fight. But when the trumpet sounds, it's then you want your Gadite, isn't it? You can think of Mr. Valiant for the Truth in Pilgrim's Progress. When they meet him, his sword is drawn and his face is bloody. And he's fought until his sword cleaves to his hand. And he says, "When the blood ran through my fingers, then I fought with most courage." And so they ask Mr. Valiant for Truth, "What about all the difficulties, all the discouragements, all the opposition, all the heartaches you face, all the things that have sought to turn you out of the way?" And Greatheart says to him, "Did none of these things discourage you?" And Valiant for Truth says, "No, they seemed as so many nothings." And that's a Gadite. We'll sing Mr. Valiant for Truth's song in a little while. But it says, "Whoso beset him round with dismal stories do but themselves confound. His strength the more is. No lion can him fright. He'll with a giant fight, but he will have a right to be a pilgrim. More than a match." That's a Gadite. And Christian friends, that tribe, by virtue of its position, it was a buffer tribe, wasn't it? It was there to protect the other tribes. It was there to deliver other tribes. It was there so that they could enjoy a measure of peace. So thank God for the Gadites in the church. And do you aspire to be one? And Christian friend, if you're not a Gadite, it's not in your spiritual DNA to be spoiling for a fight in that sense. Do you encourage the Gadites? Do you encourage the men and women who God has called to be like that? Do you stand with them? Do you pray for them? Is it that they're leading the charge and they get so far and they turn around and they find they're completely on their own? You said you'd pray for them. You said you'd pray with them. You said you'd be there. When it came to the crunch, they were on their own. And wives, do you encourage your husbands to be champing at the bit for Jesus? Or when you see that spirit in him, do you try and, as it were, becalm him? To make him docile? So he's got more time for you than for Jesus. Better to have him home on a Wednesday night than to have him on the prayer meeting, at the prayer meeting on a Wednesday night. And you're talking about a volunteering for the Lord's work. So when he's champing at the bit and wants to be up and doing for Jesus, and you're trying to settle and quieten him down. We must encourage our Gadites. And parents, you have difficult children. I remember talking to parents, and their child was now considerably older, but when he was young, they said he was so difficult. He was always spoiling for a fight. When there was any trouble going on, he seemed to be at the heart of it. But what happened? He got saved. So who was standing up in the open air dealing with the hecklers? It was that same difficult child. Because now you see all those qualities that have been so difficult to handle. Now under the king's discipline, now in the king's army, they proved mighty in battle. So if your child is difficult, don't lose heart. Maybe it's in there, that sense of revving and wanting to go forward. Well, under God, what might become of it? And young lads, maybe you feel you're tough. You'll know nothing until you enlist in the king's army. But as we close this point, there's a sense in which we're all called to be Gadites. So come with me to the reading which we had, Revelation chapter 14. Revelation 14. Now, where are we? Well, verse 1, we're told we're on Mount Zion. And verses 3 and 5, we're told we're before the throne. In other words, Revelation 14, we're in heaven. Who's there? Verse 1, "Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion." Jesus is there. And who's with him? And with him 144,000. And who do these 144,000 belong to? Verse 1, having his father's name written on their foreheads. These 144,000 who are with Christ, they belong to God. Okay, well, who are they? Are they a literal 144,000? No. Like all the numbers in Revelation, the number is symbolic. So what does a number represent? If it's a symbolic number, what does it mean? Well, in Scripture, the people of God are sometimes represented by the 12 tribes of Israel. And the people of God are sometimes represented by the 12 apostles. So 12 times 12 equals 144. These people represent the people of God. Okay, but where'd you get the 1,000 from? There are 144,000, not just 144. Well, again, in Revelation, 1,000, or 10 times 10 times 10, is symbolic of completeness. So you have 12 times 12 times 1,000 equals 144,000. In other words, this number represents a complete number, a full number of God's people. Does it represent the total number of God's people? No, because we're told, verse 4, that these are the first fruits. They're not the whole harvest. So it's a complete number, but it's not the full number of God's people, of God's elect. And verse 3, they sing a new song. And again, you'll find, particularly if you look in the Psalms, wherever a new song is spoken of, it's symbolic of victory. Whenever there was a victory, they sang a new song. So this new song they sing is a song of victory. And then rather mysteriously, verse 4, we're told they're virgins. These are the ones who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. Again, we're not to take it literally. It's speaking to us in pictures and symbols. You remember Uriah the Hittite? David tries to get Uriah to sleep with his wife Bathsheba in order to cover up his own sin. And Uriah refuses. And why does he refuse? Because he's a soldier. And at the moment, the army is on the battlefield. And because the army is on the battlefield, because the army is at war, he feels his fellowship is with them, and therefore he doesn't sleep with his wife. In other words, here are people who've kept themselves in a perpetual state of war. They've kept themselves from civilian affairs. They've kept themselves from normal life to become dedicated soldiers of Jesus. And verse 5, we're told they're blameless and true. So who are they? Who are these people? There's a complete number, but it's not the total number of God's people. They're the first fruits of a greater harvest. And there they are, singing in glory the victor's song, having fought a holy war, having refused to compromise with the world. So who are they? They're the martyrs. They're the martyrs of a great and terrible persecution in the days of Nero. Now, do you see, as John writes, he's writing to the churches in Asia Minor. That's some distance away from Rome. And as he writes, he tells them they know that a terrible persecution is coming their way. Many of them are going to lay down their lives for Christ. But, says John to these churches who are about to face a terrible persecution, don't lose heart. Your brothers and sisters who laid down their lives, your brothers and sisters who were martyred under Nero, look where they are now. Look, they're on Mount Zion. They're in heaven. Verse 4, they're with the Lamb. They're with Jesus wherever he goes. And they sing the victor's song. Having suffered for Jesus on earth, they triumph with him in heaven. Having borne the cross, they now wear the crown. Look, he says, look where they are. See them. That great number. They're on Mount Zion. They're singing the victor's song, a song of triumph. Their holy war has come to an end. And now they're with Jesus. And think of Mr. Valiant for the truth. Because all these 144,000, they've been valiant for the truth, haven't they? And Bunyan says, as he stepped down into the river, he said, oh, death, where is your sting? And he went a little deeper. And he said, grave, where is your victory? And as he passed over, all the trumpets sounded. Do you see? This 144,000, as Gadites, they've triumphed at last. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were the redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no deceit, for they are without fault, where? Before the throne of God. He encourages believers who are about to face persecution by pointing them to those who've come through persecution and are now in glory, by pointing them to Gadites. It says, as they have been, so you will now have to be yourselves. But look where they are. So don't fear. Don't lose heart. And soon you'll be joining them. Now, Christian friends, who knows what persecution is coming to us in the days to come? Why should we be an exception? God's people all over the world are persecuted for Christ. All over the world, believers are dying because they belong to Jesus. Today, Christians will die. They will be put to death for no other reason than they belong to Jesus Christ. Why should we be any different? I was telling with a believer, a brother, last week. He said to me, I wouldn't be surprised if I was in prison in 5 years' time. Not for some nefarious activity, but because and for being a Christian. Because of the place that he occupies, the sort of work that he does, where he finds himself, he wouldn't be surprised if he's going to have to make a stand, and the consequence will be that he will feel the force of the law and be put in prison for simply being faithful and obedient to Christ. Do you see, we're all called to be Gadites, aren't we? We're all called to fight a holy war. But when that day comes, will we be more than a match? Is persecution coming? Well, how shall I identify with Jesus in that day if I draw back from him in this day? How shall I in that day stand the heat of persecution if in this day I'm cold and indifferent and half-hearted? How shall I expect to sing the victor's song if now I'm dancing to the tune of the world? If you want to follow the Lamb wherever he goes then you must follow the Lamb today. Christian friend, why wait till persecution forces the issue? Why not give up all for Jesus now? Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. Unashamed to be a Gadite, knowing that soon we will sing the victor's song. Well, now much more briefly, let's look at the tribe of Asher. What can we say about Asher? Asher, the tribe of Asher, the land of plenty. Look at verse 20. Bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Now, Asher, he's a son. Jacob's talking to him. His name means fortunate, lucky, happy. And you can read about it and why he's called that in Genesis chapter 30. And as is his name, happy, so is his future. Or is it? Now, when the promised land came to be divided up, Asher was given a prime location. If the whole of the promised land flowed with milk and honey, Asher perhaps received the best of the land. If you're on this side, you're in the promised land, Asher would be this corner over here, stretching up probably to the Organ, into the north. The north of the promised land, overlooking the Mediterranean, and it was a beautiful, rich countryside. It was on the hills overlooking the Med. You know the advertisement, this is not just any food, this is M&S food. And so they said, this is not just any food, this is Asher food. Bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. He produces food that's fit for a king's table. Asher, if you like, is the gold-topped tribe. Asher, the land of plenty. Or as Moses puts it, he says of Asher, he says, Asher is the most blessed of sons. Let him be favored by his brothers, and let him dip his foot in oil. Your sandals shall be of iron and bronze, and as your days, so shall your strength be. Asher, abundance, fullness, blessing. His name is happy. Their place in the promised land will be happy. It'll be just oozing with fullness and abundance. The land flows with milk and honey. How much more the land of Asher? Which raises the question. Why does Asher have it so easy when Gad over there has it so hard? There you are, Christian friend. You're battling every step of the way. You look across to brothers or sisters, and as you look at them, you think, well, life is so much better for them. How can that be right? I'm a Gadite battling away. They're an Asherite enjoying plenty. Or there's a church, and that church is flourishing in sunlit uplands. While another church is under constant assault. They just lurch from one crisis to the next. How can that be right? Well, it's right because Asher is not Gad and Gad is not Asher. You're not them and they're not you. In the kingdom, God will have his Ashers and he will have his Gads. And the nail-pierced hand which has designed their situation, that same hand has designed your situation. So what should your reaction be to the Ashers? Well, do you remember Peter, having just been told by Jesus what the future holds and how he will die? Peter looks at John and he says to Jesus, yes, but Lord, what about this man? And Jesus says to him, what's that to you? You follow me. Are you a Gad? And they're an Asher? And life is hard for you? And life is easy for them? And you look across, you say, but Lord! And he will say to you, what's that to you? You follow me. Stop looking at them. Start following me. And if you are an Asher, why have you been so blessed? Is it anything in you? Are you special? Are you different? And are the blessings for your table? For your benefit? Bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. In other words, Christian friend, in whatever way God has blessed you, those blessings ultimately are for his table. Those blessings with which he's blessed you are ultimately to be used in his service. So are they? Maybe, Christian friend, you have a great deal. You have much. But how much of that much is pressed into the king's service? To whom much is given, much will be required. Which brings us to another question. Asher was blessed, but we've got to say this. Asher was blessed, but was he? Was he really blessed? Isn't it interesting that from the tribe of Asher comes no judge, no warrior, no leader, no prophet? That for all the tribe's abundance, it all seems to come to nothing. The only notable Asherite is Anna the prophetess. Do you see up there in the north, overlooking the Mediterranean, on those sun-kissed slopes? There they were in the warmth and the sun. Asher, we're told, Judges 1 verse 32, settled down to a peaceful coexistence with the Canaanites. And they traded with the Phoenicians further to the north. And over the generations, all those advantages, instead of being used for the kingdom, instead of being an outstanding tribe which their position gave them, it all came to nothing. So, Christian friend, have you grown up in a Christian home? That's an immense privilege. You don't know the quantity, don't know how to quantify that. If you've grown up in a Christian home, you don't know what you've been spared from. How good God is to you. To grow up in a Christian home is an immense privilege. Have you grown up in a church where the Bible's been faithfully taught? That's a privilege. And have you grown up surrounded by godly examples? What a blessing. And have you found yourself in a full and busy and active church? What a blessing. And have you been given great gifts and great abilities? What a blessing. And what should we say of home and family and living standards compared, say, with our brothers and sisters in Sri Lanka? All of us in that regard are privileged and blessed. In that sense, we have the best of the land, don't we? Bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Christian friend, have you been given so much? By virtue of the place where God has put you, the world you've grown up in, the church you've grown up in, the things that God has given you, the gifts he's pressed into your hands. Do you have the best of the land? Well, Christian friends, in another sense, if that is so, you are also in great danger. It's not the Gadites who are in danger. It's the Asherites. Constant raiding, constant assaults puts the Gadites on their guard. It's the Asherites who are in the real danger. Because prosperity, abundance, ease kill the Christian life. Listen to Stuart Olliott. What is easy is ungodly. The soft option has a killing touch. It transmits a deadly virus. Slowly but surely, it puts an end to spiritual life. Christian friend, if God has prospered us, if he has blessed us, if he has given us those privileges, it is so that we are to become more useful in the kingdom of God. So does it. So much from the Lord, so little to show for it. Is that you, Christian friend? So it's others who put themselves out. It's others who change their plans and their lifestyle and their routines for Christ. It's others who speak to visitors. It's others who come to the prayer meeting. It's others who are involved in the work of the gospel here. What do you do? It's others who can be relied upon. It's others who visit the sick and the needy. It's others who open their homes. It's others who give generously. If the king has blessed you, if he has put you in that place where Asher enjoyed such abundance and fullness, it is then that your first and your best is to be given to him. Bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Because, says Jesus, everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. Should we read that again? For to everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. And to whom much has been committed, of him they will ask the more, says the head of the church. the Lord Jesus Christ. Asher, the land of plenty. Christian friend, do you see continued prosperity is a fiery trial?